Thank you, John. Thanks for that introduction, and it's certainly a pleasure to be participating in this IFR event. So in a world of unconventional policies, assessing the stance of monetary policy is not as straightforward as it once was. It used to be that looking at the board's cash rate target and coming to a view on its likely path provided a reasonable summary of the stance of monetary policy. If the cash rate target was lowered, the traded cash rate would decline to that lower rate, and policy had clearly then moved to a more expansionary footing. The mechanics of the first stage of monetary transmission was also well understood. The cash rate anchored very short-term interest rates. Along with expectations of the future evolution of the cash rate, this influenced rates right out along the risk-free yield curve. And in turn, that affected rates on corporate bonds, mortgages, and other financial products that reference different points along the yield curve. Key asset prices, such as the exchange rate and equity prices, they also reacted to changes in the yield curve. So using the cash rate as a summary statistic was quite a reasonable way to think about the stance of policy, and the transmission mechanism to financial prices was clear. However, this all became more complex after 19th of March this year in Australia, when the Reserve Bank introduced a new package of policy measures. Some of these were within the realm of conventional monetary policy tools, but others were unconventional. So in particular, the board reduced the cash rate target to 20.25% and provided forward guidance indicating that the cash rate would not be increased until the board was confident of meeting its employment and inflation objectives. It also set a target for the three-year Australian government bond yield of around 0.25% to be achieved by purchasing government bonds in the secondary market. Purchases would also be conducted as required to address dislocation affecting government bond markets at that time. It introduced the term funding facility, providing three-year secured funding to banks, also at 0.25%. And it announced that the bank would continue to provide liquidity to Australian financial markets by conducting repo operations at terms of up to 6 months in its daily market operations. It's clear that this package of policy measures represented a significant easing in the stance of monetary policy. The aim has been to lower funding costs across the economy and support the provision of credit, and it's broadly worked as expected. At the same time, however, it's no longer possible to summarise the stance of policy merely by referencing the cash rate target alone. Other elements of the policy package have to be taken into account. So these other elements affect the transmission mechanism in various ways. And today I'm going to discuss these channels and how they work, and I think that'll also help to clarify how we can assess the stance of monetary policy. So I find it helpful to split our policy tools into two broad groups. First, there are interest rate tools which are primarily focused on achieving a particular interest rate, such as the cash rate target, forward guidance, and the bond yield target. These are relatively straightforward to assess, but the obvious point is that we need to look at more than just the current cash rate. Excuse me 1 minute. There we go. And second, the other set of tools are ones that operate by providing liquidity or longer-term funding. These also affect various interest rates, but in somewhat less obvious ways. Moreover, these tools contribute to the RBA's to growth in the RBA's balance sheet and result in important compositional changes in terms of the type and maturity of instruments held on our balance sheet. Hence, examining the balance sheet is a complementary way of assessing the stance of monetary policy. So I'm going to consider each of these types of policies in turn. Starting with interest rate tools, the reduction in the cash rate target by 50 basis points to 25 basis points in March, that pulled down the short end of the yield curve. That was straightforward. More novel was the use of forward guidance and the three-year yield target. The board wants to see labour market conditions that are consistent with inflation being sustainably in the 2 to 3% target range, and it will not be increasing the cash rate until actual inflation is sustainably in the target range. This forward guidance has contributed to interest rates being lower than otherwise, as rates across the economy depend, among other things, on expectations of future cash rates. This effect is being reinforced by the bank's three-year yield target. by committing to keep the three-year Australian government bond yield at around 0.25%, we've directly affected interest rates at that point on the yield curve. The effect of the resulting changes in the short end of the yield curve in other financial markets, rates and prices is standard. Lower risk-free interest rates pull down interest rates for other financial products throughout the economy. In addition, lower returns on Australian dollar assets contribute to a lower exchange rate than otherwise. Also, the actual cash rate, as you can see here in red, has moved to be below the cash rate target in blue. That's driven by those other parts of the package that are contributing to a rise in liquidity and funding provided to the banks. I'll turn to each of these elements as I discuss the balance sheet tools we've been using. So in March, during the early days of the pandemic and following the sharp rise in financial market volatility, the Reserve Bank increased the supply of liquidity to the banking system via our normal daily open market operations. The provision of large amounts of short-term liquidity to the banking system is a long-standing tool of central banks used during periods of financial dislocation. So the purchases of government bonds and the take-up of the TFF, that contributed to a further significant rise in liquidity in the banking system. And as expected, the actual cash rate, again shown here in red, that's the rate that banks charge themselves to lend out funds to other banks overnight. That declined to be below the cash rate target. It settled at around 13 basis points, which is just above the 10 basis points shown on the dashed line here that banks receive on surplus exchange settlement balances left in their accounts at the Reserve Bank. The decline in the cash rate to below the target was a natural consequence of the expansion of balance sheet. It's worth noting that this need not have been the case, however. Instead, the bank could have sterilised the liquidity impact of bond purchases and the TFF by draining surplus ES balances, for example, by using term deposits. But by not sterilising the effect of these policy tools, the banks provided more monetary stimulus than otherwise. This extra liquidity also underpinned lower interest rates in other short-term money markets, and this includes the bank bill market, which is shown here. That's a key benchmark affecting banks' funding costs. Because banks are generally flush with cash, they don't need to compete very hard to raise short-term funds. In fact, since about mid-April, banks have been able to borrow funds for terms of up to 3 months, at or below the expected cash rate. And that's what's shown here. This is the lowest spread in at least 2 decades. As well as supporting the three-year yield target, bond purchases have added directly to banks' ES balances, and so they've contributed to low money market rates. And this effect will be in play for a while, given that the bonds purchased will contribute to the Reserve Bank's balance sheet for some time. So while bond purchases under the bank's yield target are clearly an interest rate tool, they also share some of the aspects of balance sheet tools. The term funding facility provides low-cost funding to banks for a period of up to 3 years. Competitive pressures in lending markets mean that reductions in funding costs associated with the TFF have been passed through to business and household borrowers. But the TFF has lowered a broader range of interest rates in the economy and put more money into the hands of borrowers and investors. To understand how that's occurred, it's helpful to consider what the banks could do with the money from the TFF. And essentially, they have three broad options. They could first write new loans to households or businesses, or second, they could purchase securities such as government or corporate bonds, and third, they could also replace other forms of funding such as bank bonds. So let me consider each of those. So first, banks may choose to use money from the TFF to write new loans to households or businesses. To do so, banks first need to attract new borrowers, so they have an incentive to pass on the lower cost of funding offered by the TFF to those borrowers. This was clearly evident in the mortgage market, where banks have competed for new high-quality borrowers with a reduction in rates, as well as offers of cash back to borrowers for refinancing existing loan held with another lender. Moreover, banks are now sizable declines in interest rates on fixed-rate business and housing loans, very shortly after our package of measures was announced in March. Second, if a bank chooses to use the money from the TFF to buy a bond issued by a government or a private business, this has a very similar effect, but it occurs via capital markets instead of the loan market. The act of bidding for a bond drives its price up and its yield down. Buying the bonds also extends a form of credit to the issuer if it's purchased in the primary market, or the bank can buy the bond from an existing investor who's then likely to recycle those funds by buying another asset. And so via this chain, the TFF can work to drive down yields on a range of assets, both public and private. The third thing a bank can do is it could use money from the TFF to repay its maturing debt. So this has the effect of lowering the yield on Australian dollar assets. For example, in normal circumstances, a bank would typically issue a new bond to repay an existing maturing bond. And investors holding the maturing bank bond would normally use the proceeds to invest in a new bank bond. If instead, however, the bank uses money from the TFF to repay that bond and so does not issue a new one, then the investors are left with cash but no new bank bond to buy. And so they have to find something else in which to invest. And the resulting adjustment from that process in the market will help to drive up the price and lower the yield on the asset or assets in question. So in each of these three cases, the use of TFF funds results in lower interest rates in the economy. And in the case where the TFF is used to buy a bond or make a loan, it also results in new funding finding its way to a borrower or an investor. So that is, there's a quantity effect as well as an interest rate effect, whereby an expansion in the Reserve Bank's balance sheet can lead to additional funding ending up with households, businesses, or indeed governments. So if we pull all of this together, it's clear that assessing the stance of monetary policy is very different in a world of unconventional monetary policies. One useful way to deal with the new complexity is to recognize that many of these new tools will lead to changes not only in the size, but also in the composition and the maturity of central bank balance sheets. So balance sheet metrics can provide useful additional insights into the stance of policy. So most obviously, the provision of liquidity, purchasing of government bonds, and the funding provided under the TFF, they involve expanding the size of the Reserve Bank's balance sheet. And you can see that I skipped ahead one. Generally, an increase in the balance sheet size under the new policy measures means that the Reserve Bank has acquired an asset from the private sector, at least for some time, and in doing so provided some form of monetary stimulus. This form of stimulus has clearly been evident through this year. It was also evident, as you can see here in this chart, during the run-up in the bank's balance sheet during the global financial crisis. And that was a period when the Reserve Bank satisfied the sharp increase in demand for liquidity at that time of extreme uncertainty. So the composition of the balance sheet also reveals how the various monetary policy tools are being used. In the early stages of the pandemic, liquidity was supplied via OMOs and hence the domestic repo market. So you can see that ramp up in the dark blue part of this chart. While the foreign exchange swap book in grey, that was allowed to run off. There was also a sizable increase attributable to the bank's purchases of government bonds, shown in orange here. More recently, the TFF has played an increasing role. Most of the bank's initial allowances were drawn down by the 30th of September deadline that applied to that part of the facility. At the same time, short-term repos have been rolling off. This change in the composition of the bank's balance sheet is clearly evident in the large rise in the average residual maturity of assets held by the bank, which you can see in the lower panel of this chart. So this is consistent with the need for monetary policy support to be provided for some time, given the economic outlook and the prospect of an extended period of high unemployment. This perspective of the balance sheet size and its composition is useful for comparing our current suite of policy measures with the stimulus that was undertaken during the GFC. The reduction in the cash rate target was much larger during the GFC, down by 400 basis points compared with a reduction of 50 basis points this year. Of course, that reflects the fact that more recently the cash rate has been close to its effective lower bound. But in both cases, the initial expansion in the balance sheet was in the order of about 5% of GDP. But in the current episode, the nature of that expansion has been quite different compared with the GFC. During the GFC, the main focus of active balance sheet expansion, and by active, I mean what's shown here in graph four, the main focus of that was on satisfying the precautionary demand for short-term liquidity. While a depreciation in the Australian dollar, that also boosted the value of the bank, the RBA's foreign asset reserve asset. So that contributed also to some increase in our balance sheet, which is not shown here. Satisfying precautionary demand was also important in the early stages of the pandemic, but subsequently the mix of assets has shifted to longer-term repos via the TFF, as well as government bonds. Consequently, the breadth and the durability of the easing in financial conditions that's been associated with these balance sheet tools has been greater now than it was during the GFC. So pulling this all together, I'll just make a couple of concluding remarks. The bank is using a number of monetary policy tools as part of the package of measures it adopted to support the economy through the pandemic. This means that the task of assessing the stance of monetary policy is very different and more complex than it used to be. Some of the tools influence interest rates directly in a way that gives us greater control over a wider range of rates than previously. In particular, forward guidance and the three-year yield target have supported historically low borrowing rates at this maturity. Other elements of the package affect interest rates indirectly and are harder to assess. But the extent of stimulus from these sources can be gauged in the first instance by considering their effect on the RBA balance sheet, hence my use of the term balance sheet tools. A key example of this has been the TFF, which was recently expanded by $57 billion to around $200 billion. We expect that much of this extra funding will be drawn upon in time for the simple reason that it will be profitable for banks to do so. And when this happens, a new long-lived asset will be added to the Reserve Bank's balance sheet. The banks will use the funds to write loans to businesses and households, to buy securities or repay debt, all of which will serve to lower interest rates in the economy and extend funding to the private and indeed to the public sector. So I look forward to your questions and discussion in the roundtable, in the panel. So John, back to you. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Chris. That was very enlightening. I'll just introduce the panel, first of all, before we go to the questions relating to your speech. We've got here today Chris Dickman, the Senior Portfolio Manager at Altius Asset Management, Andrew Kennedy, Director Treasury Services at South Australian Government Financing Authority, Anthony Robson, CAO and Managing Director of Eurobroker, Darren Sloan, Director of Debt Syndicate at ANZ, Andrew Walsh, Managing Director and Head of Australia-New Zealand G10 Rates Trading at Citi, and Jeremy Zook, Director of Sovereign Ratings for Fitch. Unfortunately, Andrew Walsh and Darren Sloan are only available in dial-in at the moment, so that's why you can't see their faces. But the first question I'd like to ask comes from Belinda Chong at CBA, and her question for you, Chris, is, has the RBA conducted a monetary policy framework review in the same way as the Fed, Bank of England, and the ECB is doing or have done?
Thanks for that question, Belinda. The answer is not a formal one. No, we did have, though, a thorough discussion of the inflation targeting framework that's been used by the bank a couple of years ago by way of a conference where we invited a series of well-known academics and other central bankers to come and present at our conference here in Sydney. But no, we haven't had a formal review of the framework in the way that the Fed has. It doesn't mean we're not always thinking about underneath that, particularly with regards to our policies, how they're working, how effective they are. So, thanks.
Okay, thank you, Chris. I've got a question from Swati Pandey at Thomson Reuters, and her question is about expanding the balance sheet. She said markets are predicting the RBA would soon start buying 5 to 10 year Australian government bonds and semis. Could you provide some insight on the board's thinking there? And secondly, if the RBA were to start buying longer dated debt, what form would it take?
Yeah, well, I think we've made it clear, including recently in both a speech by the Deputy Governor and the Governor, about the fact that the board is continuing to consider the case for additional monetary policy easing. That's intended to provide further support to jobs and the overall economy. And as the Governor sort of noted recently, it's worth thinking about that, of course, now that those policies, any such further policies might gain a bit more traction now the economies are opening up further, including in Victoria. I can't really speculate on a lot of details about exactly what they're considering, other than just to echo what the Deputy Governor's already said. So he noted quite clearly that one option was, in fact, to buy bonds further out the curve to supplement the three-year yield target, and that those purchases further out could occur on a regular basis. So I think most people would think that as QE. And the intention there is to bring down longer-term, the longer end of the yield curve. That would reduce funding costs, most obviously for governments, but also the private sector, since risk-free yield curve is a key benchmark. It probably also have some additional portfolio balancing effects, including on the exchange rate. And one effect would, and one imagines, a lower exchange rate than otherwise. But the more than that, I can't really speculate. Thanks, John.
Thanks, Chris. A question here from Matthew Squires of Bank of America. Has the board given any thought to where the surplus ESA rate, the corridor floor, might move to if or when the cash rate is reduced further, which the market is pricing in for the November meeting?
Yes. So, well, as going back to what the Deputy Governor has already mentioned, another option is, of course, to lower somewhat the current structure of short-end rates that we have in place through our various tools. And he noted, of course, not into negative territory, but there's still a little room to compress those further. So that would be the cash rate target, the yield target, but also the remuneration on ES balances, which is currently at 10. So those all could go a little lower than they currently are.
Okay. And Matthew's asked a second question. He says the TFF has been untapped for the last 2 weeks. Are you concerned banks will delay tapping additional TFF until nearer to the June 30th deadline in order to either term out their funding and or benefit from further reductions in TFF rates before then?
No, I'm not concerned. I mean, these sorts of questions were being asked around the early months of the TFF when we had the initial allowance that was open until the 30th of September. I think I've given fairly detailed comments of that in a speech fairly recently about the mechanics of the decisions that are facing the banks. At the moment, because short-term funding rates are very low and even lower than the TFF rate, it makes sense if the banks don't need those longer-term three-year funds available through the TFF right now. It makes sense for them to hold off for a time and take it up closer to the deadline applies to that part of the TFF. So that sort of makes sense. And then on the other hand, they have to balance the fact that maybe they don't want all of to take it all out right at the last minute, because that imposes a larger funding burden at the other end of things. And I think banks have shown with the initial allowance that they've come in kind of late, that made economic sense, but they've spread those to a degree, and they're going to manage the liquidity at the other end of things very carefully and quite well, I'm sure.
Okay, Matthew's coming with another question. If BBSW's, I guess, Matthew, could you repeat the question? Because I'm not sure what you said. I'll come back to that one, Matthew, because it's not come out clearly what you mean there. But there's a question now from Dick Rickard at Refinitiv, and this is for the whole panel. Has there been a notable impact on trade volumes in Australian government bonds and semi-government instruments compared to prior to the TFF being put in place? And if so, has this been domestically driven, or is it from offshore investors? Does anyone from the panel want to have a crack at that?
It's Darren from ANZ. I could touch on that briefly. I mean, certainly since the introduction of the TFF, we have seen an increased level of demand generally from both the domestic and offshore investors. There's a number of factors, not just the driven by the TFF, that is adding to that. I mean, looking at, say, from a domestic point of view, obviously with the impact of the TFF and also recent moves or announcements in regards to the CLF, that's only heightened domestic demand for Australian Commonwealth government bonds and semi-government bonds from balance sheets. But also looking at offshore, we've seen a number of factors such as the move where the Aussie-US spread has moved into positive territory, which is the first time since early 2018, and that certainly has driven a large increase in offshore demand. Adding to that, an attractiveness on a hedge basis from other offshore centres such as Japan and Korea. So there's certainly been an uptick generally in demand, certainly offsetting the large increases in supply that we have seen in from both the Commonwealth and the state. So we've seen a very constructive investor backdrop.
Okay, thanks, Darren. Just quick, back to Matthew. This is Matthew's question. If BBSW was to set below 0%, so for example, if the RBA cut rates again further, would this concern the RBA given the board's previous opposition to negative interest rates in Australia?
No, I think the board's focused very much on the policy tools and the interest rates that we have direct control over. It would not be unexpected for BBSW to potentially pop below zero. It's spent a bit of time, as I showed in my chart, a bit below OIS. But it wouldn't be far below zero, and it's a wholesale rate. It doesn't necessarily imply anything about, let's say, the interest rates banks charge to their retail depositors.
Okay. Let's see. Okay, this is a question from Sophia Rodriguez from Central Bank Intel, and it's a question for Andrew Kennedy. Dr. Kent just said one of the aims of any bond buying is at the longer end of the curve would be to reduce government borrowing costs. How do you think it will impact on your borrowing plan?
Thanks, John. Thanks, Sophia, for the question. We don't necessarily target rates when we come to borrow. What we're looking to do is to match fund our balance sheet to our clients' borrowing activities. So I think there'd be a number of different considerations that we would have to weigh up, but they wouldn't necessarily affect how we went about borrowing funds against our program. They'd be more concerned around what the appetite was from the state's clients in regard to their borrowing opportunities. I think it's probably worth noting, as Darren alluded to before, that we've seen a positive Aussie-US curve, which has helped some of the supply-demand dynamics. Obviously, if we saw negative rates at the front end of the curve or lower borrowing costs at the back end of the curve, that did affect some of that demand dynamic from offshore investors for Australian product, but that may have implications as to appetite for state and government bonds. So it's not necessarily as much as saying this is a fantastic outcome. It's more about, are we going to be able to have access to markets to raise funds at the time and for the term that's required to meet our clients' borrowings?
Okay. Thank you, Andrew. Now I've got a question for the panel. First of all, I'm going to ask it to Chris Dickman, Portfolio Manager at Altius Asset Management. And the question is, which policies do you believe the RBA and other Australian authorities have adopted since the coronavirus outbreak have been the most important and worked the best? And is there anything that they could have done better or earlier?
Thanks for the question, John. I guess there's two parts to that. The most challenging part from a markets perspective was when the global lockdown sort of first came into being, and the Saudi-Russian oil fracker escalated, pushing oil prices precipitously lower. So with that, the liquidation of assets was quite, you know, furious. So that included obviously treasuries and Aussie sovereign bonds. So I'm touching on the rather than rallying, the acute, you know, dislocation meant that over a 10-day period, the 10-year bonds sold off about 2%. So the Reserve Bank buying intervention along the bond curve was actually critical policy. It restored liquidity and the defensive elements of, you know, of sovereign bonds. I guess one could argue that the buying action itself was more meaningful than the for the bid offer spreads and market functionality than the earlier kind of liquidity provisioning. That was certainly a very profound policy introduced. And then once normality kind of resumed, the RBA equally stepped out. Other central banks, you know, kind of tend to linger longer and add to the distortions. So that's kind of the first part of that question, I guess. The second is just to do with the yield curve control point plus the RBA, you know, banking and term funding facilities. I think they're wise and you know, policies. They recognise Australia's a bit different perhaps than other markets insofar as we're much more of a banked market. The banks play a more pivotal role compared to, say, the US, where you've got corporate bond access is far more important there. So early in the crisis, the TFF stabilised the banks, that stabilised their bond funding programs and financing rates. And then I guess subsequently, it's a key monetary policy. So, you know, they should provide greater efficacy as you know, can I just describe there with respect to fiscal policy, you know, infrastructure spending, etc. And then hopefully it transmits to the small to medium-sized enterprise sector as well, given that most SMEs really, their financing comes through mortgages. So many of the smaller banks are, you know, mortgage lenders rather than commercial lenders. So that's an important point to pick up on there.
Okay. Thanks, Chris. Can I ask the same question to Andrew Walsh, who's head of Australia-New Zealand G10 rates trading at Citi? Andrew.
Yeah, thanks, John. I mean, I think that the bank was very transparent and open and about their policies and the way they use the TFF to use banks to transmit funding and lower rates through the economy. So that was very effective. I'll sort of move on to what the markets are looking at now and the focus since Dr. Lowe's speech last week, which was, as Chris alluded to in his questions already, the potential for further QE. Commentators have jumped on this as a reason for within the world of relativities for the RBA looking to get the exchange rate lower. We're not so totally convinced by that. I mean, the RBA owns about 8% of the float of government bonds outstanding, whereas the RBNZ, as another example, owns about 25% of bonds outstanding, and they've been very aggressive in their buyback programs this year. Over that period, the New Zealand TWI has still increased. Now, admittedly, that's been over a period of a weak US dollar where the New Zealand dollar generally outperforms, but it's not a direct pass-through link. Even saying that, we still think, you know, it's an effective measure. It's sort of like part of the Team Australia game. And as Chris said, as the economy moves into upswing to provide further support to SMEs and small businesses is hopefully a very, you know, a policy that will gain traction and help the economy through and help jobs as their objective states. The interesting thing, I guess, out of this is for investors, as we've heard from Darren, you know, like offshore portfolio investors have probably moved overweight Aussie fixed income this year from an underweight position over the last couple of years in government bonds, simply because of the differential to US rates. You know, since the crisis, we've probably averaged around 20 to 25 over, when we now sit at flat with the expectation of further QE from the bank at the November meeting. So that may say have some impact on investor demand at the margin. However, further out the curve in the ultras, that's a part of the curve that from our offshore client base is very highly sought after. The steepness of our curve there is the widest in the world. And, you know, on an outright yield basis, there's great demand out of Asia and Japan for our product there in both government and semi-government paper. And then also just on an asset swap basis for investors in say Europe, they can swap an Aussie bond back to their own currency and still pick up 30 basis points in government space, and then an extra 50 or so in semi space if they're looking at that way. And the returns are even higher for Canadian investors. So those parts of the curve for investors will remain appealing, and the feedback from our offshore investor base is that part, the ultra part of the curve, will remain very much in vogue for them on the Aussie curve. However, with the differential back to zero against the US, we're probably going to see a little bit reduced demand in the shorter end of the sector, shorter end of the bond sector curve now.
Thank you, Andrew. And the same question to Jeremy Zucker at Fitch Ratings. And the question is about which policies will work best, introduced by the RBA and the other Australian authorities, and is there anything they could have done better or quicker?
Yeah, I think from our view, comparing it more globally, the RBA and the Australian fiscal authorities have been quite responsive and effective in their response to the coronavirus shock. I think from our view, yield curve control has certainly been a key factor, and our house view is that the RBA will extend targeting further down the curve. Here I want to touch on the other panelists have gone into great detail on the monetary response, just briefly on the fiscal response as well. Looking at the other Australian authorities, we've seen quite a strong fiscal response in Australia that's played a good complement to what the RBA has done. Australia's fiscal response compared to others globally has been quite an active use of fiscal policy, and certainly the amount of fiscal stimulus provided by the Australian authorities has been relatively high compared to others. So I think there's been some good complementary actions as well between what the RBA has done and what other authorities in Australia have done as well.
Thank you very much, Jeremy. Next question is about the impact of the huge amount of increase in government issuance from the Commonwealth and the states. I studied economics in the 1980s, and the argument then was if you increase government supply, you'd cause a lot of inflation and crowding out. Now, this hasn't happened. And what happened to the deficit and debt disaster talk? As far as I can see, the extra liquidity you have in the Australian market appears to have outweighed excess supply as far as international investors are concerned. So, Andrew, what do you think about that? Why hasn't huge increase in supply from the states and the federal government caused problems?
Yeah. Thanks, John. I think it's worth just having a look at what that increased supply has looked like. So over the last 12 months, we've seen total supply of government and semi-government debt up by roughly about 25% from circa $800 billion of term debt to now just over $1 trillion. And I think it's worth identifying that, there has been a lot of talk about the fact that we've seen a massive increase in debt. And certainly when you look over the forward estimates for government and state government budgets, and obviously there's a lot of state governments still to report, including South Australia, over the next month or so, that you'd expect those forward projections for debt to continue to increase. And we did certainly see in March when markets were dislocating and liquidity was at a premium, that we did see some concerns about that increased supply of debt. And we did see some blowouts in spreads. We saw or heard anecdotal evidence of offshore divesting. And we did, obviously, with the change to the withdrawals from superannuation, we saw domestic funds also liquidating, which caused some supply digestion in the local market. However, markets repriced very, very quickly. And, primarily due to the fact that we had strong central bank support in terms of their bond buying, targeting a three-year bond yield at 25 basis points. Notably, since they've come into the market, and whilst they haven't been active lately, they've bought $78 billion of government and semi-government securities since they first started their program. So, they've also obviously added liquidity through both their open market operations and the term funding facility. So we've had central bank support that's helped balance some of the supply in the initial instance, and then we've seen strong demand from investors. And you know, Darren will be able to talk to this better than I can around what some of those demand from both domestic and offshore investors has looked like. But certainly when we've gone to issue in markets, as I think our peers would also attest to, that there has been widespread distribution of our bonds both domestically and offshore. Yeah, and some of the reasons for these are basically that Australia is still seen as a safe haven investment. It has relatively high rates amongst the AAA block. And there's also a very stable political environment, unlike some of the other geopolitical risks that we're seeing globally at this point in time. So, you know, as far as we're concerned, does the does this deficit and debt problem continue to be there? Yeah, I think there's still some noise in the background, and there still is some work to be done in terms of the fact that there's a lot of heavy lifting to be done by government borrowing agencies, not just in Australia, but globally. But there is also that offsetting factor at this point in time in terms of increased investor demand and central bank support for markets.
Thank you, Andrew. And so, Darren, what have you seen on, as far as the investor side is concerned, about how they're reacting to all the extra supply from Canberra and the States?
Yeah, thanks, John. I mean, in terms of the demand side of things, I very much touched on that that last question, but it is it's driven by, the introduction of the TFF and the change to the CLF, the Aussie-US moving into positive territory, curve shape, as mentioned by Andrew earlier, attractive hedge costs, attractive carry. So there's a number of aspects and a number of things that are pointing to putting investors to the Aussie dollar market, to Australian Commonwealth Government bonds, to semi-government bonds. I think from a demand perspective, we have been in a good space. We continue to be in a good space. There's obviously a number of moving parts to this going forward, and there's obviously potential for further action by the RBA in the form of QE. But we'll have to see how that transpires. In terms of, say, you mentioned in the question, there's a crowding out effect. There's very little evidence of that. In fact, I think what we're seeing with the economic outlook is a drop in private sector investment and intention. So the business credit growth has been weak and will remain weak for some time, I would think. So there is little risk of crowding out, and I'd assume that to be the case for at least the medium term anyway.
Thanks, Darren. The next question is about Australia's rating. It's one of 10 countries to have AAA ratings from all three main agencies. My question, first of all, to Jeremy at Fitch Ratings is, could Australia lose its AAA rating status? And if so, so what?
Yeah, thanks, John. Well, we put Australia's AAA rating on negative outlook back in May, and that was really just a reflection of the significant deterioration that we were expecting in public finances as a result of the pandemic. And so while we do think that Australia has fiscal space to respond to the coronavirus shock, certainly from here on out, that fiscal space becomes much more limited. And so from our view, it really becomes important about what we see as the government's plans over the medium term, and whether the gross debt to GDP level stabilizes or goes on a downward trajectory over that medium term horizon. So that's really what we'll be looking for in terms of where the rating goes. The federal government in its recent budget does put forward a plan to stabilize debt over the medium term. We do still see a lot of risks around that outlook. If we see more substantial scarring in the Australian economy as a result of the coronavirus shock, that could weigh further on growth, required a longer period for unemployment to drop below the government's sort of 6% unemployment rate threshold that they've set. So there are still a lot of risks to this, and so we'll be paying close attention to the medium-term fiscal outlook for the government. One thing to note is that we do have a sort of a record number of sovereigns on negative outlook at the moment, including Australia, and then also in the AAA category, the United States. And we do expect the conversion rate of the negative outlooks to be probably a little lower than what we typically have, but still there is a risk. And so certainly for the question on so what, I suppose I'll leave it to the market participants to discuss on the panel to discuss, you know, the implications for borrowing costs, as there are certainly a lot of factors that contribute to borrowing costs beyond the rating itself. But from our view, you know, AAA is a very a rather exclusive and stable set of sovereigns, and we have 10 sovereigns at the moment that are on at a AAA rating after we downgraded Canada this past June. This is the lowest number of sovereigns that we've had at AAA. And of course, once a sovereign does lose its AAA status, it can be quite difficult to regain that. We have not had so far a case where a sovereign has regained AAA since losing it. So, you know, from our view, we do view AAAs as sort of quite an elite group of sovereigns, and so once that is lost, it is quite difficult to regain. One final point is that if, you know, in the event that we were to downgrade Australia, I think it would also depend on whether markets view this as a one-off downgrade or the beginning of a trend in downgrades. And from my view, the latter wouldn't really be the case for Australia at the moment.
Okay, thank you. And same question to Anthony Robson at Yieldbroker, particularly what would it matter if Australia lost its AAA status? Anthony, can you hear? Okay.
John, can I offer a comment while we're waiting for Anthony to possibly come back in?
Go ahead, Chris.
Yeah, look, I think maybe I'm just echoing some of what's already been said, but I think the starting point is to reflect that the high current rating reflects a long history of very sound management of public finances in this country, both at state and federal levels. It's true, debt, of course, will rise with deficits. The two go hand in hand, but that's part of the very crucial fiscal support that we're seeing. Debt's still low, both at state and federal levels. I think the key issue is, while I'm not disputing that the ratings may change, I think the key is not to focus on any potential change in the ratings that come from that rise in debt. Instead, I just focus on the fact that I think the rise in debt is very manageable. It's certainly affordable given interest rates are as low as they've ever been, and it's the right thing to do for the economy. I think the other question is the effect, if any, if there was to be a ratings change, what effect, if any, it would have on the price, on the cost of debt, and the experience of other advanced economies is not very much because the main feature of the global economy at the moment is interest rates are as low as they've ever been. Thanks.
Okay. Thank you. Okay. Is Andrew wrong?
Maybe I could jump in there.
Go on, Chris. Yeah. Chris Dickman?
I was just going to make the point, picking up what Chris just said there. If you have a look at the UK, they were just downgraded, and their 10-year bond yields actually rallied to 16 basis points. So it kind of underscores the point that the critical role that central banks are, you know, playing in dominating bond markets is because of a monetary policy tool rather than an investment per se.
Okay.
And also, John, if I just made the point, in the semi-government space already, you have TCOR and TCV at AAA, but QTC at AA+. So you already have that sort of delineation there. And despite the other two potentially being downgraded soon, that the impact on their spreads is not marked.
Can you hear me now, John?
Who's that? Is that Anthony?
That's Anthony.
Anthony, yeah. I just want your views on what would be the impact if Australia did lose its AAA status.
Look, I just heard the end of what Andrew was saying, and I think there's a couple of pertinent points. First and foremost, there are only 10 AAA-rated countries. I think there's only 4 AA+ rated countries globally. We represent a relatively small percentage of total investment on a global basis. I think it's about 4% on the index. And the relative benefit that investors have received over a very long period in investing in Australia has been quite significant. So I think the memories of that corporate memory from investors globally is still very strong. Australia is still would still be a very high rated currency. I think the bigger issue is actually where we would sit on as a relative return to some of the bigger economies like the US. And I think that was touched on earlier. You know, at flat to the US, it's a different relative value than at 20 over or 40 over, which is where we were a few months ago. The impact at the end of the day is just a demand supply impact. We know that there's going to be supply. It's a question of whether the demand comes, and there aren't that many choices for high rated debt across the world. As far as AAA and AA plus are concerned, so I personally I don't think the impact is going to be huge.
Yeah, no, I think that's the general consensus, seeing as what happened in with treasuries and with gilts, as Chris said. My next question is about the possibility of negative interest rates in Australia, and whether they would be welcomed or a sign of desperation. It causes more harm than good. So I've got you there, Anthony. Would you like to answer your thoughts on the potential for negative rates in Australia and what it means?
Look, I think anything's possible, but, personal perspective, I don't think it's necessarily desirable. One of the things we're hearing about in the press is the lack of availability of a return for our retirees. And that's it's certainly a growing investor class within this country. I think we've seen, and the RBA has been at pains to explain this over the last few months, that while it may cause a bit of a sugar hit in the initial stages, the longer term impacts are questionable at best. And if you look at, say, the European, I think you've got four sovereign bonds in Europe at the moment that are trading in 10 years, that are trading under zero. I think you've got Germany, Switzerland, and two others, France. The impact on that, on those markets in particular, with a rapidly growing aging population. And in fact, that average working age increasing very quickly, the impact on social welfare is enormous. Now, we don't have quite that problem in Australia. We do actually have a positive population growth, which is good, and particularly in that tax-paying bracket, that 30 to 50-year-old bracket. So we don't have those problems. The benefit we do have right now too is that, we do get a pickup as far as yield is concerned. I think it's quite dangerous going down a negative interest rate path, though, with a growing retiree population. It forces them to take a lot more risk to generate the sort of returns that they expected to get with the nest eggs that they had.
Okay, thanks, Anthony. Can I ask the same question to Andrew Walsh at Citi?
Yeah, sure, John. Effectively, I think the RBA has been very transparent, like I said, about using banks as their transmission mechanism through this whole crisis. And if we look at the offshore experiences in Europe and Japan where negative rates have been adopted, the equity prices of those bank stocks has been significant laggard. And I think that just shows that the institutions that suffer the most out of this is sort of the hand that feeds the economy in this environment. So, and that's the banks. So I think the RBA are very reluctant. They've been very quite public and vocal about this, all the members of the committee. I think that their approach is as we discussed earlier on the call, will be a lot more to do with QE and flattening term premium and term structures on the curve before they go down the path of negative rates. And negative rates may only come back into the equation when we're talking about relativities again. And hopefully that's not the case, and that, the economic upswing can take place.
Okay. Thank you. Thanks, Andrew. Now, the next question is for Andrew Kennedy, and it's about the Aonia linked market, because Safra is the only issuer besides CBA RMBS to issue Aonia linked notes. And I wondered, is the progress in this market stalled because of TFF and other and the current monetary policy? And also, what does the future hold for an Australian risk-free reference rate?
Thanks, John. I think there's a number of things to consider here. And the first part of it is that the end of IBORs haven't changed. You know, going forward, the IBOR suites will be phased out, and that's well known. In Australia, obviously, the Reserve Bank is supportive of a multi-approach to short-term interest rate benchmarks, and one of those that obviously we're very supportive of and we've seen other support for has been Aonia. Now, this has obviously been a way that we've wanted to scope our short-term borrowing program. Yes, there's been some changes to the dynamics of the front end of the market, especially with the results of the extra liquidity, the TFF, that has seen the RBA cash rate trade below the target cash rate, and you know, large amounts being left in ES accounts. And that has affected some of that supply dynamics for short-term issuance. But it doesn't change the fact that the IBOR suites will be phased out over time. There's been no change in when they're going to be removed in offshore markets. So the need for a risk-free rate benchmark in Australia still remains very, very strong. And certainly there's a number of considerations for both borrowers and issuers in the space around how they're looking to manage their short-term interest rate risk. Because whilst we do have this liquidity being supplied to markets at the moment through central bank activity, it's not going to be there forever, nor is it going to be infinite. And so when markets do return to some sort of pre-COVID dynamic, then you will have a change in what some of these short-term funding instruments and dynamics look like. And being able to have a choice for issuers and investors regarding how they want to manage their short-term funding risks or their short-term investment risk is going to be an important consideration going forward. So, you know, whilst there might have been some, I'm not sure whether intended or unintended consequences from what we've seen from the central bank actions, it doesn't take away from the fact that as an issuer, I still believe it's an appropriate benchmark for us to be building into our investment products, and we're going to be continuing to use it because, you know, we're a government organisation using a risk-free rate is what the risk that reflects what our borrowers want to see within their within the products that they're using to manage their risk. So it still remains very relevant as far as I can see. And certainly we've seen, whilst we haven't seen other issuers racing to the table to come and use this as a format, it doesn't mean that it's still not relevant or there's still not work being done. We've just seen some changes in market dynamics where people had to focus, I guess, on other parts of their businesses just due to what we've seen in the changing conditions across global markets, not just Australia. You know, I think it'd probably be worth tapping into Darren here to see what his thoughts are around the investor piece regarding different benchmarks.
Yeah, definitely. I think in terms of the investor base for the Aonia product, we've certainly seen it develop over time with moving from the inaugural transaction out to more recently this year. We've done a number of issues. Certainly, we've seen the interest and demand across the number of investors grow, certainly dramatically. I mean, even when we look out to the longer tenor issue that was done, that's probably the best example of where we've seen a really strong growth in investor demand. And the granularity of the book there was a real testament to this product and how well it's being taken up by investors in this market. And I expect that to continue on as well.
John, it's Chris Kenny, can I add one thing? I'm just going to say that as the RBA as the administrator of Aonia, the sort of the cash rate benchmark we're all talking about here, we've made sure that we have robust fallbacks built into the cash rate procedures. So for those times, and there have been more of them of late given the high level of liquidity in the system, for those times when volumes traded in the cash market are insufficient to calculate a transaction-based rate, we've still been able to publish the cash rate, and I think people should rest assured it's a robust benchmark in that regard, and it continues to reflect interest rates that are relevant in the unsecured overnight funding market.
Okay. Thanks, Chris. Next question is about green bonds from Rob Fowler at Essential Change. Obviously, some of the states, the three of these states have issued green bonds. I think New South Wales have just issued one, a new 10-year green bond today. A lot of overseas sovereigns have issued green bonds. Germany had a massive order book for one earlier in the year. And I just wondered, I don't think we can ask what the prospects are of a Commonwealth government green bond. But if they did do one, what would be I'm going to ask Chris Dickerman and Darren this. What would be the demand, you think, for a sovereign green bond? And could it potentially price inside the standard sovereign curve? So if I've asked that to Chris, what do you think the reception would be for a sovereign green bond from Australia?
Well, I guess we started an ESG fund, you know, 7 or 8 years ago, and then we've recently launched a green bond fund. So we're very, very keen to invest in more high quality assets. And clearly we're not on our own. So I think that the appetite would be, you know, quite significant. Just, you know, from what I've seen this morning, the TQR 30 issue today had about $4 billion of bids. Issue size looks like about $1.3 billion. Which, you know, came at a yield pretty flat to the non-green, for lack of a better word, TCOR curve. So that probably gives you a bit of an insight on in terms of the demand and the pricing dynamics that are at play. And from a government's perspective, I would have thought it's a pretty attractive thing to do. And as far as, you know, there's a Canadian study, not sure if everyone's seen that, it suggests about 5 times as many jobs associated with green energy projects compared to conventional. So in an environment where the government's all about jobs, green infrastructure projects will have particular attraction in that environment anyway.
Thanks, Chris. Darren, what do you see about demand for green bonds in relation to standard bonds from the states and the Commonwealth?
Yeah, in terms of demand side, very much both domestically and offshore, the demand for what's called ESG issuance, including green bonds, is only growing. It has been over recent years and continues to grow. It's obviously been evidenced by the increased issuance from, as you mentioned, from the states, New South Wales, Victoria and Queensland have all been active in that regard. So too other sovereign issuers. And look, I would suggest that the AOFM has been very closely monitoring these things, but you know, it's an attractive pocket of demand, or I'd say it's greater than a pocket of demand currently that issuers are certainly taking note of. What we have found domestically is that investors prefer to really be, especially in the semi-government, and I would suggest the Commonwealth would be similar, they really would prefer to see green issuance, let's call it, in line with benchmark curves. There is some weighting which is now starting to potentially drive that green issuance or ESG issuance inside of benchmark curves, and we have seen that evidence offshore, more so in Europe than the US, but certainly we are seeing that as a trend. So I think, look, it is obviously of great interest to all issuers. And I think what we've seen over, especially from the states, is that the government was in each of those cases probably the initial driver in terms of having that inaugural issue. And ideally we'd see the federal government sort of move in that regard and ideally lead the Commonwealth to issue something along those lines. But it's very much for them to comment on, I would suggest, rather than us making assumptions. But another aspect which maybe Andrew Kennedy might like to touch on, in terms of rather than say an issue which is more bespoke in terms of a green bond, looking at somewhat of a programmatic issue, whereas having the program classified as either under an ESG type scenario.
Yeah, thanks. I am happy to talk to that. It's been a landscape that's developed significantly, especially over the last 5 or 6 years, to where it's now commonplace for issuers to want to tag their investments as green or sustainable, and investors to want to have portfolios that are certainly tailored towards those style investments. But I would make one point here in the way that we've gone about considering this, and that is when you look across what governments do, whether they're Commonwealth governments or state governments, they're basically meeting the criteria of the UN Sustainable Development Goals in everything they do, whether it's environment, whether it's social, whether it's governance. They're ticking off, well, ticking off's not the right word, but they're achieving ESG objectives in everything that they do. Social housing, providing support for your hospitals, for your education, for your underprivileged. It's part of what the governments do as their mandate. So trying to say that you want to isolate a certain number of these assets to secure a small amount of your portfolio, I'm not necessarily sure that's the right way to go. And when I look at SAFR, say, as a smaller issuer, there has to be a better way of not risking the liquidity you have in your curve by isolating a small number of your a small amount of debt within your portfolio. So what we're trying to do here across South Australia, which SAFR has taken the lead on, is to develop an across-government framework to ensure that everything that the government is involved in and that SAFR is involved in financing does meet the UN sustainability goals in terms of how projects are known and appreciated to be funded. So, we're not wanting to go out there and say, hey, let's just do a green bond issue for the sake of doing a green bond issue for labelling purposes. I want to make sure that we're doing things with the right approach, with the right long-term strategic objectives that will be able to provide confidence to investors that if no matter which piece of SAFR debt they're investing in, that the general use of proceeds will meet the criteria of the UN Sustainable Development Goals, because I think that's more important.
Okay. Thank you, Andrew. This is a question for Chris from Michael Heath at Bloomberg News. And Michael says, your speech seems to be a rebuttal of some of the criticism of the RBA that it hasn't done enough to respond to the crisis. Do you acknowledge that the RBA is doing less than most of its counterparts? And if so, what makes Australia different?
Well, I think my response would just say, I think we have provided significant support to the economy in the right ways, especially as it was noted earlier in the panel discussion early on with the addressing the most critical problems, particularly bond market dysfunction. I think the other thing that we've said of late is that the board, in considering what further measures it might undertake to provide further support for jobs and the economy more broadly, are focused on the issue of the traction such policies would gain. And the governor's kind of said, well, look, now that the economy is opening up, any further support would gain a little bit more traction. I think the other really important thing to focus on, and I think we've touched on that already in the policy discussion, in the panel discussion earlier today, is just that fiscal policy is really playing a very crucial role. And the fiscal policy support has been very substantial and important in supporting people's incomes and supporting jobs. And monetary policy is helping to support that. So I think those are the really critical things to focus on.
Okay. Thanks, Chris. This is a question from Kit Lowe at Lowe Capital Management, and it's for Jeremy. Jeremy, do Fitch take into account the amount of central bank buying as a percentage of outstanding issuance when assigning ratings?
So on that, we don't take the percentage as a total of the outstanding debt directly into our ratings. Certainly the impact that it has on government borrowing costs in that it generally lowers those government borrowing costs does have a positive impact on the rating, just in terms of lowering government debt service, allowing governments to sort of carry a larger debt burden more sustainably. So that does factor into our rating assessments, certainly in a positive way, at least in the near term. So that's really how we look at QE. I guess more broadly, you know, we do have a discussion as to the impacts on perhaps central bank independence, but that's not the a discussion really in the case of Australia, just a broader view on our approach in some emerging markets in particular. But yeah, generally a positive effect just in terms of the impact on borrowing costs.
Thank you. Thanks, Jeremy. Right, let's see what other questions we've got here. This is from David Rickard at Refinitiv. Has the organised structure of the Australian market impacted the success response to the use of TFF, or have there been other factors such as our ratings or something else? Has the organised structure of the Australian market impacted the successful response to the use of TFF, or have there been other factors such as our ratings or something else? So whilst TFF being so successful, I guess I'm not sure how to answer that.
I'm not quite sure where it's going with that one. And maybe you can resend that one to you.
Okay, yeah, we can have a look at that individually. I think he means why is TFF being so successful? I guess it's the reasons he said, you know, the structure of the market, and the strong ratings and other. Okay, let's move on to this is from Andrew Janshek. What does inflation sustainably in the range mean in practice?
I think that's one thing the governor tried to clarify in his most recent speech. The first thing is that first, we actually have to see a measure of inflation in that 2 to 3% range. Second, inflation, particularly in underlying terms, tends to be a fairly slow-moving measure. So once it's in the 2 to 3% range, particularly if it's been on an upward trajectory, one imagines it will stay there for a time. And that's something that is subject to some degree of judgment and will be explicit in our forecasts. So first and foremost, actual inflation has to be in that 2 to 3% range before the board would consider tightening monetary policy, raising the cash rate. And secondly, for it to be sustainable, one imagines we've got to have forecasts having it stay in that range for a good time.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you, Chris. This is from Watan Larindo at CCB. With the RBA considering buying 10, 15, 20-year Australian commercial bank bonds, with the core covenant being that they be used for own-occupied mortgages. And it says, it goes on, this would enable the banks to provide 10, 15, 20-year fixed loans at very low rates, thus giving households confidence to increase spending. Importantly, could such a program be extended to second-tier banks?
Well, I mean, the demand for various reasons for fixed rate loans out that length just have never really been there in Australia. And I think it's from lack of demand rather than the banks not wanting to do the financial engineering to make them a viable product. Fixed rate loans make up a fairly modest share of total lending for mortgages. And even those are fixed for 1, 2, or most 3 years typically. So it's not clear to me that the supply is a constraint rather than the demand. And that's for all sorts of reasons, including the treatment of mortgages for tax purposes. So Australian households like paying their mortgages down quickly. That's not a bad thing. That's a good thing for financial stability. That's been the norm for many a year in Australia, and I suspect it will be continuing.
Okay, Chris. Are there any other questions from the panel for Chris? Has he answered everything to everyone's satisfaction then?
Okay, I've got one more for Chris, if that's all right. So, Chris, with the amount on the ES balances at the moment, a lot of the TFF money is sort of going back into that into that, as along with the bond buying that you mentioned earlier. Now, the credit growth scenario doesn't look that rosy in the short to near term. So potentially, TFF money is negative carry for banks who are borrowing it at 25 cents and then lending it back on the overnight rate at 10 cents. Does that factor into, how does the RBA look at that? Does those sort of negative carry implications factor into your policy decisions and into your discussions?
I think it's more a question that, I mean, it's a good issue you've raised. I think it's more a question for the banks as to whether or not they want to take up the option of TFF. And I think they've shown when we approached that deadline for the initial allowance, which was almost all of it was taken up, that if you're doing a calculation before that deadline that says, what can I use these funds for? And if you're just going to park them in your balances and not lend them out or find some other use for them, then yeah, that is a negative carry, because at the moment you pay 25 basis points for the funds and you receive 10. But if you do have a borrower that you want to lend out to, well, then you'll get a pickup there, and it'll be profitable for a bank to lend that money out, particularly for business, and most particularly for small and medium-sized enterprises, because we give the bank that does expand their lending to business extra TFF allocations, extra access to cheap TFF funds. And I think the other thing they can think about, and this is what I went through in the speech, they could think about the time that a bond is rolling off of their own, and those are rolling off at, if they were to replace them, they'd have to issue a bond at much more than 25 basis points at the moment. So it would make sense for them to use TFF funds to replace those funding sources. And then, as I suggested, they could use the funds to invest in bonds, government and corporate, and even government debt, just slightly out the curve beyond the three-year point, will give them some sort of yield pickup.
Okay, thanks, Chris. I've got a question from Matthew Mulcahy at Macquarie, and it's basically there's been strong demand for Australian government bonds, particularly at the long end, because the Australian curve is steeper, is relatively steep versus its global peers. If the RBA launches full-blown QE now and flattens the curve, does this work against the increased demand and force the RBA to buy more of the supply? Like, if the curve flattens, we're going to see less demand for longer dated government bonds.
So I don't think that's quite the right way to think about it. If the bank was to pursue a QE program where they're buying a regular amount of government bonds further out the curve, the way I think about that is that's additional demand coming into the market.
Right.
And that additional demand is pushing up the price and pushing down the yield. And some investors, which will be buying those funds off, may be encouraged to take their money elsewhere, invest in other assets. That's true. So the share of other investors in the market will decline to the extent we've bought a bond. That has to be true. But I don't think that forces other investors to suddenly up and leave the market, and somehow we have to keep coming in and sort of absorb a larger and larger share of the market. We're just adding to demand. So demand has to go up, price has to go up, and therefore the yield has to come down.
Understood.
I think in terms of flows, when we saw, in terms of the relative value piece, investors will look at it and say, well, that the relative value argument of adding to, say, let's call it a 10-year point of the curve in Aussie, becomes less with those yields coming down, the spreads, say, going negative to the US. I would have suggested we saw some reaction to that move post the recent speech by Governor Lowe, when we saw that large flattening in that threes tens curve. So we saw a number of offshore investors selling out. And that's, you know, that's the potential where we do start to see if that bond buying in the 10-year part of the curve moves it dramatically enough that offshore investors find the relative value argument unattractive to add to Aussie. That might be where Matt's pointing to, that that does that imply that you need to buy additional to cater for that lack of demand that's potentially gone from offshore?
Well, I just wouldn't call it a lack of demand. We've come in and added to demand, and foreigners have sold to us, and they might be inclined at lower yields to invest in other assets, including non-Aussie dollar assets. So that's partly how you get the exchange rate effect that is part of that, you know, one of the effects of such a policy if we were to pursue it.
Okay, thank you. A quick question from Adrian Janczak, and he says, this is for Chris, do you think the use of TFF might conceivably lower lending standards and therefore create its own financial stability risks?
No, I don't. The TFF is just replacing more expensive sources of funding, and banks are passing on that through lower borrowing costs. I don't see that it would be a strong motivation for a significant decline in lending standards. And I think, as we've been suggested already in our discussion today by other members of the panel, I think one of the things that's more likely to constrain the growth of credit is demand, particularly on the business side of things. That's a reflection of the uncertain economic environment we're in, and businesses are cautious about pursuing investment opportunities.
Okay. Thank you, Chris. Is any other questions, or we can wrap it up there if there aren't any? Okay. Well, thank you. Thank you, Chris, and thank you to the panel, and thank you to Fitch and ANZ and Citi for sponsoring today's roundtable and the webcast, and to hear the keynote speech from Dr. Christopher Kent. Thank you very much indeed, everybody.
Thank you, John. Thanks, everybody.